Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Saturday morning live group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How are you all doing this morning? It's a real pleasure to see everybody here this morning, and as we do every week, we want to start out by welcoming anybody who is new to this group. If you are here at Saturday morning live for the first time, we hope you enjoy it. Hope you get something out of it that's useful in your AA program. And if you're new to AA, if you are just arriving in this fellowship, everybody here knows how you feel. All of us went through that being new, coming in here and wondering what the hell is going on and why'd they pick on me, and I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic. I think my doctor overreacted. I may have a small problem, but certainly not in the gigantic category like the rest of these drunks in this room. I mean, all of those feelings that you have when you're new, and possibly some resentment and anger and fear and anxiety and just all these things that race through our body when we have stopped drinking and are confronted with something like AA. And all we can suggest, if you are new, is to just disregard that and don't act on that, and just stick around and give yourself time in this program to calm down and make a good decision, because there's a lot of wonderful things in store for you here, and there's a lot of wonderful people that want to show you how to get out of that hellhole you've been in all these years, and we're experts at that. That's our specialty, is showing people how to get out of that mess that your life has become, and everybody really wants to do that. So please stick around and see what happens. It's customary to start our meeting with our preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting to our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And if you're new, you're going to hear this at every meeting that you go to, just about everyone anyway, and if you listen real close, it basically describes the whole AA program in that little preamble, and it serves as a constant reminder of what we're doing here, and 150 meetings every day in the Washington, D.C. area, so there's a lot of people doing what we're doing. And it won't take you too long to figure out what's really happening is we're able to do something as a group that we wouldn't be able to do on our own. You take a bunch of people who on their own have been total failures as far as alcohol is concerned, put us all together in one room, and instead of having a bigger failure, we have this incredible success known as AA. Somehow we're able to help each other stay sober, and when we all stay sober as a group, then each one of us as an individual succeeds. So instead of trying to do it alone, we become part of something, and that something is our AA group and Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship. Again, I want to welcome you and also mention that this is a little bit different format for an AA meeting. It's done in a classroom setting. We've got four or five of these in the Washington, D.C. area. And they were started maybe 25 years ago. We could have a place where you could go and know that they're going to talk about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It would be somebody who'd been in the program a long time. And you wouldn't have to sit there and worry what you're going to say when it's your turn to talk on the seventh step or whatever. And so you could just sit back and take in a perspective on our program. I try the best of my ability. I know the people, other people that work these meetings, do these meetings, try to follow the AA literature. I feel it's important that we pass on the same message that was passed on back in the 30s because it works. It doesn't need to be changed. The results that AA have been getting have been phenomenal. And so this is what this meeting, and probably all meetings are about, is to pass on this message to the next alcoholic. This particular meeting, Saturday Morning Live, we go through the 12 steps one at a time. At the end of those 12 weeks, we have 1 week on the traditions of AA, which we had last week. how the fellowship interacts with itself and so on down, and with the outside world. And then we have 2 weeks on the history of AA, the amazing story of how this organization got assembled in the first place, and that's what we're starting this morning. Before I do that, let me just say to those of you that are new, the reason that we emphasize the steps of AA, and that's basically what this meeting is that we just go over the steps constantly. We go through 12 steps, we come back, start all over again, go through them. It's because that's the AA program. That is what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's the 12 steps. And the 12 steps are how individual members of Alcoholics Anonymous stay sober and happy. That's what the 12 steps are for, to enable an alcoholic to stay sober and happy. And notice I said sober and happy. They have to go together. It's almost impossible to stay sober and miserable for any extended period of time. That's what going on the wagon was. And people with a lot of willpower, and they could stand pain, and they go, "I just don't drink." And the neck muscles are sticking out to here, and they're going, "What are you doing?" "I'm not drinking." And it's just, and it's such a sacrifice and a tremendous amount of effort. That is not drinking. But that's not what we're talking about in here. We're talking about freedom from alcohol and the ability to be sober and happy with not drinking. And that's the miracle that occurs as a result of these 12 steps. And these steps are basically a game plan for living. And the primary purpose of this game plan for living is to replace your plan. And the reason for replacing your plan is your plan is getting crappy results. That's what was hammered home to me is, yeah, you're smart, you put together all this stuff, you know this, but you're a mess. You don't have any friends. You're neurotic. You're shaking. You're full of anxiety. You're full of resentment. You got liver damage. You're wearing a wristband. You've been hospitalized. You're going through detox. You have DWIs. You get fired from jobs. People can't stand you. Your family doesn't want to talk to you. But you think you got a good plan for living. Just needs a few minor tune-ups here. And what we confront here are results. And we don't compare your theory with AA's theory. We compare your results with AA's results. And that's what the meetings are for, to let you look at people, listen to them with 3 months sobriety, 6 months, 15 years, likely. And you get to see what the results of the 12 steps are. And that's what it means in our literature when we say, if you want what we have, this is how you get there, through these 12 steps. And so each week we go through the 12 steps, but this week and the following week, we have the fun of going through the history of AA and the amazing story of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think is just one of the most fascinating adventures in the world. And a good way of starting about AA, I always like to do this. Alcoholics Anonymous started in the most unlikely place in the world, where our two co-founders came from. You don't have to be in this country too long to realize that things are constantly starting in California and sweeping across. You know what I'm talking about? Fads and social ideas and blah, 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 all these new wave thinking and all this stuff. Guess what? That's not true of Alcoholics Anonymous. We started with two guys from Vermont and worked the other way, and went across the country from east to west. And it gives me great pleasure, because I come from New England, to finally see and be part of something that didn't start in California. Although it's one of my favorite states, and I may live there someday, so I better qualify my comments. Two guys from Vermont, two hopeless alcoholics from Vermont, somehow had a series of events occur that produced, and they were actually agents for these events to occur, that ended up with a fellowship that is now getting people sober in over 125 countries in the world. The AA literature has been translated into many languages. The big book and the 12 and 12 gets translated into a new language. They take it to the country, and the alcoholics start getting sober and happy. That's the power of what occurred as a result of these two guys from Vermont. And these two co-founders, Dr. Bob Smith and Bill Wilson, are very opposites. Dr. Bob grew up in Vermont and went to Dartmouth, and early on, ever since he was about 9 years old, he knew he wanted to be a doctor. And he set about that, and he got his medical degree, and he settled in Akron, Ohio, and he became a surgeon. And he was a very quiet type of person. He liked to read a lot. He read about a book every day, and he loved cars. Fast cars was his one little excitement. But he was very much just try to go put one foot in front of the other, keep life simple, and just go straight ahead. The opposite personality is Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson is grandiose, stockbroker. He grew up and went into the World War I in the military and went on to Wall Street, and just grandiose ideas. I'm going to become a millionaire. I'm blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to be famous, and I'm going to do all these things. Just a super salesman. And my friend Clancy out from California has this wonderful way of describing the perfect match that these two personalities were. And he said, if there was just Bill Wilson, he would have sold the rights of AA to Hollywood in 1945. And if it was just Dr. Bob, AA would just now be getting out of Akron. Well, let's get one more sobered up this year. No, actually, Dr. Bob worked with thousands of them in Akron, but I mean, he was not a promoter in any sense. And so we had this wonderful balance of forces where Bill is trying to race off and do all these things, and Dr. Bob is sort of guiding and holding back this stuff. The real story, I suppose, of Alcoholics Anonymous and the forces, because these two gentlemen had no plans to start out AA and didn't know anything about sobriety or anything like that. They were just two guys that grew up in Vermont. And the real story about the forces, whatever it was that gave us this wonderful gift, I think about it myself, and I just think that this had to be thought up in the universe somewhere, where whatever power there is looked down on the planet Earth and said, I don't think they're ever going to do anything about alcoholism, because since the beginning of time, alcoholics have had this problem that we have. They've died from it. They've become outcasts. They used to put them in institutions, transfer them from job to job, and nothing was ever done. Society ended up ignoring alcohol. Just pretend they're not there. You just sort of deny that you have a problem. Denial is incredible. I mean, that's why we have this whole Al-Anon organization. And you can see that families pretend there's no alcoholic in the family. You come over and say, well, what about the drunk here in your family? What drunk? The one here lying on the floor, drunk. Oh, that drunk. Oh, you mean Dad. Oh, well, he's just resting down here. It's not a big thing. And so it's easier to pretend that there's no problem. And society as a whole has pretended that there's no alcoholism from as long as I can remember. I've never read an obituary column where it said, Joe Blow died of alcoholism, age 62. It's always died of complications or died of long-standing illness, but never is the truth in there. Never does it say the truth. Die of something else, it's in there. Die of cancer, they got cancer. But no one ever died of alcoholism, because we don't have that problem. And so there's this wonderful denial that went on. And so there was this sense of the hopelessness of this, and various research and all kinds of medical attempts had been made to do something about alcoholism. They all failed. Nobody's ever laid a glove on this disease that's been around forever. And so a set of circumstances unfolded that gave us this wonderful answer to this huge problem. And it all began in a town called Manchester, Vermont. And it was a very lovely little town near the New York border and the New Hampshire border. And in this town, in the 1915-1913 era, was a cast of characters that were to all play a part in starting AA. And they were there as teenagers. They were there attending school or coming there on summer vacations or whatever. It was a lovely little summer community. And these people, one of them was Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, who was attending a prep school in Manchester. And over from Albany, New York, was a young man called Ebbie Thatcher, who was a very wealthy family from New Hampshire area. His family had a large home in New Hampshire, and they had a summer home, Manchester, Vermont. And up from New York was a very wealthy young man. His father was a millionaire named Roland Hazard. And Roland came up, and they had a home, summer home also, but like a farm almost, a very extensive properties there. And also up from New York City was a Dr. Burnham and his daughter, Lois. And these teenagers would socialize in the town and go to the country club, and they met each other. And in that group were all of the participants in the AA message. There was the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous and the founder of Al-Anon. And they're all summering in Manchester, Vermont. And they went on, and all of them except Lois ended up with a drinking problem. They all ended up, these young men. Bill went on into World War I and went over and fought the war and came back and went to Wall Street and married Lois Burnham, who he had met in there, and they set about their great adventure. But the first one to have a problem was the millionaire's son. The first one to get totally out of control with alcohol was Roland Hazard from New York. And his father, having all this money, said, "I will spend whatever it takes to get Roland well." And so he took him to whatever. Now you have an unlimited amount of money, and you're going to get someone sober. And he set about that, and he went and tried several things, and they all failed. And finally, all of the people who advised him zeroed in on one man in Switzerland, Carl Jung, world-famous psychiatrist who's studied under Sigmund Freud and then branched out and came up with all of the wonderful things we've learned from Carl Jung. And so Roland Hazard went to Switzerland and spent a year living in Switzerland with Carl Jung to get cured of alcoholism. And Carl Jung worked with him and tried to cause this huge personality change that is so necessary in recovery. And at the end of a year, he said to Roland, "I have done everything I can for you. I think you understand the situation. If you drink again, it's just going to be all over. But I think we have made so much progress that I'm very optimistic for you." And Roland thanked him, and he left to come back to the United States, and he got as far as Paris. And in Paris, someone asked him a question that just seems to get us all drunk. They said, "Would you like a drink?" And he was drunk a whole year with Dr. Jung, and he didn't make it past Paris. And he came back to Dr. Jung. And this is what many people think is one of the first huge steps in the beginning of AA occurred now, at this moment, because I want you to picture that we have the world's most famous psychiatrist, and we have a millionaire, psychiatrist and millionaire, together. And he said, "Dr. Jung, I'm back with all my money. What should we do?" Now, what do you think the answer was? It's unbelievable what the answer was. The most famous psychiatrist in the world looked at all this money and said, "There's nothing I can do for you. There is absolutely nothing I can do for you." the humility of the psychiatrist to say that. There's nothing I can do. It created what is absolutely necessary in recovery. Hopelessness. An absolute sense of despair. A bottom that had never been hit before. And Roland said, "You mean I'm going to die of alcoholism?" And he said, "Probably." He said, "There's one exception that I have read about. And I've read about this. I've never seen them, but I've read about it. There are cases just like yours who have somehow found their way into a spiritual or religious experience, and they had a massive spiritual experience which caused this personality change, and they were able to get sober. So if I was you, I would try and find a road that would take you towards one of those experiences." And so Roland said, "All right, I'm going to try." And so he looked around, and what he came up with was the Oxford group, the Oxford movement. And the Oxford movement in the 30s in this country had been started by a gentleman called Frank Buckman. Later on, this organization, this wonderful organization, turned itself into moral rearmament. And it became very political because it had gotten so big, and it practically destroyed itself. There may be some remnants of some Oxford groups left, but when it politicized itself, it just fell apart. And basically, what the Oxford movement was little groups of people who had decided, the heck with churches, the heck with formal religion. The real message of a higher power, the real message of spirituality, is what occurred in the first century of Christianity, when people just practiced the principles that had been taught. And so they got together in little groups without any ministers or without any formalized process, and they simply tried to discuss amongst themselves what spirituality was and how you could improve yourself and how you could be more useful in your community and how you could overcome personal problems and how the group could help with that. And there was a lot of prayer and there was a lot of reading from the Bible and there was a lot of these type of activities. And Roland somehow stumbled into this up in Vermont. And as a matter of fact, he donated his family's summer home and turned it into some sort of a halfway house, a retreat type thing, and he was working there. I mean, he said, "You're going to be staying with us and help these other new people," and so on down. And so Roland was doing that, and then he was staying sober. And he went down to New York, and the Oxford movement was big down there, and he helped out down in New York, but he was mainly up in Vermont. And it was about this time, after Roland had gotten about 6 months, 7 months with this Oxford movement, that the second young man that was in this summer crowd, Ebbie Thatcher, ran into terrible problems. His family up in New Hampshire said, "We don't want you to live here anymore. You go stay in the summer home in Vermont. We don't want to talk to you. We don't even want to hear about you." He was a very bad, bad drunk. And he was in this house living by himself, getting drunk all the time, just, you know, he's got money, so he's just getting drunk, out causing all kinds of problems. And one Saturday morning, he was driving his car drunk as hell, didn't make a turn, and drove straight into a farmhouse. Went through the living room, and the car came to a complete halt in the kitchen. And he got out of the car, and just with a big smile said, "Hey, anybody got a drink?" And of course, he's back to the jail, and the judge is going, "You know, this has just gone on too many times. We're going to have to do something real serious with you. If this happens one more time, you're going to be seeing lots of jail time. You're going to be disappearing for very extended periods. Do you get the message?" "I get the message," said Ebbie. "Don't worry, I get the message." So now he's reformed. You know how when you're reformed, now you come back home, "Hey, I'm reformed. No more of that. As a matter of fact, time to get constructive. It's time to do some of the things I've been putting off because of my drinking. I think I'll paint the house. This house is falling down." Race out, get some cans of paint, come in. Oh, we have a new man on our hands now. Been sober almost a day. You know? Cans of paint, paint brushes, got the ladder, and boy, oh, isn't it wonderful to be recovered and a new person. So he paints the house for 2 or 3 hours, and then he stops, and he goes out and he looks at it and he says, God, look at those 10 square feet with new paint. Doesn't it look wonderful? I can just see the whole house painted like that. So he went and got a little lawn chair, and he just was sitting there. He's tired of painting, so he decided to admire the painting. You know what I mean? He's just looking at it. And some birds came by and crapped all over the paint job that he had just done. So he went in the house and he got some shotguns and some whiskey and decided instead of painting the house, I mean, look at this. Guy tries to turn over a new leaf and gets wiped out. Screw that. Doesn't make any sense. So he's sitting in the front lawn, getting drunk, blowing birds, any bird that flies by, with a shotgun, which is making the neighbors very nervous. They're hearing all the shooting next door. So they send the cops over. Guy, and he's not supposed to be shooting those guns. Well, he's back in front of the judge, and he's going to do some long time. He's drunk again. And he gets to make one phone call, and guess who he calls? Roland. His old buddy Roland. He's the one guy he used to drink with who he thought might help him out. So he calls Roland. Roland comes in. Roland's sober. Can't believe it. And Roland takes a look at him and says, oh, boy, you're one of us, and you're just like me. I think I can. So Roland, being millionaire's son, lots of influence, says to the judge, could you release this man in my trust? I will be responsible for him. Well, yes, yeah, somebody like you, instead of jail time, we're going to release him to you. And he did. So he brought Ebbie right into the Oxford movement, right into that summer place in Manchester, Vermont. And they start talking about the Bible and talking about spirituality. And Ebbie is getting sober. And he's getting happy. And he gets sent down to work in the soup kitchen in New York, where the Oxford group had, in one of the big churches in New York, they had a soup kitchen. And they reached out to try and help people who needed help. They didn't specialize in alcoholics. They just were out to help people in general. That was their mission. And whenever he was there, for some unknown reason, he hadn't thought about Bill Wilson in the longest time, but he was working in this soup kitchen, and he said, I wonder where Bill Wilson is. I remember he and I, we did a lot of drinking. I bet you he's got a problem like I do. For some unknown reason, he thought about Bill, and so he looked him up, found out where he was. He was over in Brooklyn. At this point in time, our co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, the man who wrote the 12 and 12 and the big book, was unemployed. He had been thrown out of Wall Street because he was drunk all the time. He had been very successful on Wall Street as an investigator. He decided, this is way back when, before they didn't go out and really investigate companies they were going to invest in. They relied on the paper reports that came from the companies. And Bill came up with the idea, and he got a motorcycle with a sidecar, and he and Lois would drive around checking out potential in companies to invest in. Little tiny companies that were just starting up that didn't look like they had a chance, like Eastman Kodak, General Electric, companies like that. And he went to these places that were just starting up and would visit with them and schmooze with the guards and people who worked there, and next thing they'd invite him in, and when he was brought into the GE warehouse under the experimental place, saw all kinds of things on the drawing board they were about to come out, wrote it all up, rode the motorcycle back to New York and gave his report, and people invested tons of money into these new companies and made fortunes because his information was so good. So they wanted him on Wall Street. But he got drunk all the time, and he'd be off investigating, and you'd never hear from him, or he'd promise a report. So he had been ostracized. They're broke, no money, and Lois is working in a department store, and Bill is stealing money out of her purse in order to drink. And on this Saturday morning, he had stolen enough money for a bottle of gin. She had gone off to work, and he told her, don't worry, I'll be putting a big deal together. I'll have us out of this soon. And he's getting ready to have his bottle of gin when the phone rings, and it's his old drinking buddy, Ebbie. Well, you know, that just sort of makes the whole day. I mean, you're sitting there alone with this bottle of gin. Reality is closing in on you, and the phone rings, and it's your drinking buddy. And you go, yay! Ebby, come on over, pal. Have I got a surprise for you? Well, Ebby shows up, and Bill opens the door, and he gets real nervous because Ebby looks so good. And he just looks at him and goes, Ebby, what the hell has happened to you? You look healthy. You look wonderful, man. What's wrong? And Ebby said, Bill, I've got wonderful news, old drinking buddy. I found religion. Now, you can imagine how you'd receive that if you're sitting there with your bottle of gin and Bill's, don't worry, we'll get you over that. We'll get you over that. Don't worry about a thing. No, Bill, I have. And I've just been sober for 6 months. I'm happy. I'm doing all these wonderful. Oh, Ebby, geez, don't even tell me about that stuff. Have a drink, you know. So Bill's drinking and listening to this. And Ebby, I don't go to church. I'm not interested in any of this. I don't believe in God. I don't, you know, I mean, I studied it when I was a kid. And it's just all crap. I can't have anything to do with that. Now, Bill, and they had this long argument or discussion. And out of that discussion, Ebby suggested to Bill, well, Bill, you don't have to worry about any particular concept of God. Why don't you just have a God as you might understand him? You don't need this. And this Bill found hard to argue with. And it was the idea was planted way back then. Bill forgot it, and then it came out. You'll hear next week how it came out as the result of the groups hammering out Bill's ideas. But at this point in time, it opened up just a little bit of a window in a closed mind to the idea of something bigger than himself. That's all it did, because there was no way to argue against, well, pick your own higher power. No, that's not satisfactory. I mean, you know. So he just sort of stayed open with that idea. He didn't buy into it or do anything like that. Ebby went back to work in the Oxford group. Bill continued to drink, and he drank himself back into the hospital, Towns Hospital, where Dr. Silkworth, the second psychiatrist to play a key role in Alcoholics Anonymous, had been treating Bill. And he had told Lois that they were coming to the end of the line. He said, Bill may have one or two more times we can get him through this, but I think you're going to have to go and talk to a lawyer, and we should be getting ready to commit him, because this is the only way to keep him alive and to prevent him from killing himself. We will commit him to an insane asylum where he will be watched for the rest of his life. And so that's where they were at this moment in time, and Bill's getting drunk, and he's back in the hospital. Dr. Silkworth has him in there. Ebby comes back to see him in the hospital. He says, come on, Bill, you know, gives him one more talk about the Oxford group and leaves. And that night, Bill felt so much despair sitting in that hospital on his bed. He just felt like it was the absolute end of the world. And for some unknown reason, he suddenly just threw himself on the floor and just said, if there is a God, let him show himself now. And as Bill describes it, the room lit up so bright he couldn't even see the walls anymore. There was this wind, this rushing sound, and he just felt in perfect ecstasy. He knew he never had to drink again. And it lasted 2 or 3 minutes, this whatever was going on. And at the end of that period, he sat there sick, tired, exhausted, but at peace with himself for the first time in years. Now, picture, if you will, Dr. Silkworth. We got a guy going through detox in the hospital, and we come around to check up on him. And he says to us, Doc, you're not going to believe what just happened. I was lying on the floor, and I said, if there's a God, let him show himself. And Doc, swear, stack of Bibles, this room lit up so bright I couldn't see the walls. I was carried up to the top of a mountain. The wind was blowing. Now I want you, as I'm telling you this story, to imagine what Dr. Silkworth is going to say to Bill. We got a psychiatrist treating a guy in detox who tells him this incredible story. Miraculously, Dr. Silkworth looks at Bill and says, I've never seen you looking better. If I was you, I would go with that, what happened to you. I don't know exactly what it is, but I would go with it. Unbelievable statement to come out of a psychiatrist to just say, go with that. And so Bill did. And when he got out of there, he went and found Ebbie, and he got involved in the Oxford movement. And he's down at the soup kitchen, and he's running out, and Bill is a salesman. He's a promoter. And so anything he comes into is, you're doing this wrong. It's going too slow. This Oxford movement is going too slow. We're not getting enough drunk sobered up. I'll show you how to do it. So he just became a missionary. And for the next 6 months, Bill went out to sober up all the drunks in the world. And, you know, that still goes on in AA. You see somebody who got about 3 months sobriety, and they go, I'm going to go sober up all my friends. And it must be contagious, this sense that we can rush out with this newfound sobriety. And so Bill raced out and would talk to drunks. And he'd tell them, listen, I want to tell you what happened to me. And he'd tell them all about this burning bush and the lights and all that. He'd even go into bars. He'd say, you don't have to be in here, boys. Come over here. Let me tell you something. You don't have to be drinking that stuff. I was sitting in the room. Lights came down, the wind. I'm free as a bird. And the drunks would look at him and go, that happens to me when I drink rum. Ah. Nobody is listening. Would you listen? You're in there having a drink, and some guy's in there, hey, the bush and the lights. Jesus. You going to buy a round or not? I mean, you know. Just... So no, nobody got sober. He never got anybody sober. And he complained to Lois. Lois said one of the most amazing things. He said, it's not working, Lois. I've been doing all this stuff. I'm going to those Oxford meetings, and I'm running out, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. Nothing. I'm just a total failure. He said, it's not working. And Lois said, oh, no, it's working. He said, what do you mean? He said, you're sober. You're sober. Well, that left quite an impression on Bill. To such extent that as his job started to succeed again when he got sober, then Wall Street wanted him, and he was grandiose. Just because he was sober, he didn't stop being grandiose. And he was going to make that $1 million and get Lois away from working and get him back in the country club and get their house back and get all their furniture back and get all those good things. And so the powers that be on Wall Street said, Bill, you're back, and we got a deal for you. We trust you again, and we know how smart you are. There's a little company, a machine tool company, in Akron, Ohio. And this company is, there's a proxy fight going on. There's a group of investors on this side, and then there's our group. If you can go out there and talk to those shareholders and just do your salesman job and get that proxy fight won by our group of investors, we'll make you president of that company. We'd all get a big salary with stock. I mean, this is your chance. So now we got a drunk with 6 months sobriety off in Akron, Ohio, by himself, putting together the deal that's going to change his whole future, and the deal falls through. And the other group gets the deal, and Bill's broke. He can't pay his hotel room. He doesn't have the money to get back to New York. And it's Saturday, and he's standing in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, and the bar is right there. And they're playing music in there. You can hear the glasses tinkling and people laughing. And he just looks over there, and the thought was, I'll go in there and get a bottle of gin and be king for a day. That was just what he thought about. But something inside of him made him try something else. He said, the thought occurred to him, he better go find a drunk to help, or he's going to get drunk. And his eyes saw on this side of the lobby a list of church directories. And so he just started down calling the various ministers in the churches, and he got a hold of a Reverend Tunks. And he said, I'm a drunk from New York, and I'm trying to help somebody, and I need to find somebody right away. And they said, well, I don't have anybody, but I can give you a phone number of some Oxford group people. And Bill started calling those, and they're like, oh, I'm not in. And finally, he got this number of Henrietta Seiberling. And this is a very important name in AA history. Henrietta Seiberling, the Seiberling Tire Company, millionaires out there. This was a big tire, rubber-producing part of the country. They had all kinds of companies out there that produced tires. And Henrietta had married the son of the Seiberling thing, millionaire, so on, and divorced him. And she was living in the gatehouse of the Cyberling estate. That was her little thing. And she was very active in the Oxford movement. And as a matter of fact, they had a drunk in the middle of their Oxford group. And this drunk's name was Dr. Bob Smith. And Dr. Bob was a wonderful mainstay physician in Akron, Ohio. He had all the wonderful attributes. He was a wonderful Oxford group member. He did the praying. He did all the Bible reading. He just was drunk all the time. It was just this one small problem. And they desperately wanted to help him. And it was a tradition in these Oxford movements that when you recognized your own problem, you would come and when it moved you, you would share it, confess it with the group. And on that month, May of 1935, coincidentally, Dr. Bob had shared at his Oxford group meeting, "By the way, I have this terrible problem with alcohol. I'm sure it'll come as a surprise to all of you." And of course, they all pretended it was a surprise, but they had known it for years. And it was the tradition that if someone confessed a problem or shared it at the Oxford group, that all the rest of the group members would pray for a solution to that member's problem. So Henrietta Cyberling, as a member of that group, had been praying all month, the month of May, that a solution for Dr. Bob's alcoholism would appear. And here comes this phone call. "Hello, my name is Bill Wilson. I was given your number by Reverend Tunks, and I think I have an answer to alcoholism. And I'm wondering if you know anyone who might need my help." And it was almost, Henrietta didn't say it, but could have said, "Yes, I've been expecting your call." And she said, "Yes, I have someone. Come right over." So he came over and talked to her about it in the gatehouse, and she said, "I'll get him over here right now." This is Saturday. It's the Saturday before Mother's Day, 1935. AA is just about to be started. Picks up the phone, calls the Smith home. Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, answers the phone. Ann, wonderful news. I got the man from New York. He's got an answer for alcoholism. Bring Dr. Bob over here, and I want the two of them to get together." And Ann said, "Well, I don't think we can have the meeting right now. Dr. Bob went out to get me a Mother's Day plant. And right now, he and the plant are under the dining room table, and he's passed out. So we couldn't start AA on Saturday. It had to wait until Mother's Day, 1935. When Dr. Bob woke up Sunday morning, how many times have you woken up on Sunday morning? There's your wife. "Get up, get up, get up. We're going to see a guy from New York." "Well, I don't want to talk to a guy from New York." "No, no, guy from New York. He's here. He's got..." "Oh, Jesus." So they set the meeting for 5 o'clock in the gatehouse of Cyberling Estate. Bob's driving over and he's saying to Ann, I'll give the guy 15 minutes. I'm out of there. I don't want to talk to the guy. Where the hell's a guy from New York?" Walk in. They talk for 5 hours. There was that instant identification. Bob had never talked to anybody about what it feels like to be an alcoholic. What's going on inside? All the fears and the anxieties. And he knew he had made a connection. The two of them just connected like that on that meeting in the gatehouse. Bill, being broke, moved in with Dr. Bob. So that took care of his money problem. And he just started talking and telling Dr. Bob about the Oxford, you know, and what he'd been doing and how important it is to find other alcoholics. So they immediately were trying to search out. And at the end of 2 weeks, Dr. Bob came in and said, "Bill, this sobriety has just been wonderful for me. And it occurred to me that all these years of drinking, I have totally ignored my medical schooling. I have not kept up with my colleagues on the latest medical things. And there's a convention in Atlantic City. And I have this tremendous thirst for knowledge." Atlantic City. "And I have this tremendous thirst for knowledge. So I think I should go to Atlantic City." And so AA was about to have his first slip. And our co-founder, with 2 weeks sobriety, jumped on the train, went to Atlantic City, and got drunk as hell. In Atlantic City, coming back on the train, he was so drunk they threw him off at the wrong station. And somebody called, and Bill had to go out and get him and bring him back to Akron. And that was June 10th, 1935, which is AA's official birthday, is the day Dr. Bob came back from that slip. And to this day, and then we'll wrap it up, because I always end the first half of the AA story with Dr. Bob's slip. Seems like a nice cutoff point to pick up next week. But I always like to mention June 10th. Every year, if you get a chance, June 10th is AA's anniversary. And Akron, Ohio has a big deal. It's called Founders Day every June 10th. And if you go out to Akron, they've got maps and tours and all these things. You can go to Dr. Bob's home, which has now been preserved as a historical place, as has Bill Wilson's up in Vermont. And Dr. Bob and Ann's gravesite. We can go to the Mayflower Hotel, where Bill stood in the lobby. And you sort of just recreate Dr. Bob's office and the first AA group on Wednesday night in the hospital. It was called the School Street Group, and go down to the hospital where Dr. Bob sobered up about 5,000 alcoholics during his lifetime. And he would smuggle them in the early days and put them into the place where they sold flowers. He put a couple cots in there, the florist shop. And that was the original detox of all hospitals. And eventually, he with the Sister Ignatia, it became just incredible what they were able to do in that hospital. But if you go there, they'll give you a little map, and you tour around. And one of the great touring places is the Gatehouse on the Cyberling Estate. And it turns out the Cyberling Estate is on tour. And people come from all over to go look at how millionaires live. You know, grounds, manicured, and all these beautiful furniture and everything. So you have hundreds of people going up to tour this beautiful estate. And you have this little small band who says, I don't want to see the estate, I just want to see the Gatehouse. Because that's where it all happened. These are the drunks. These are the AA members who come there, and that's what they want to see. They want to go see the Gatehouse of Cyberling Estate, because that's where that message was first passed between Bill and Dr. Bob. And the last thing that they have on this tour is Kistler's Donut Shop, where the first AA donut was bought. I can't believe that this donut shop got on that list. But the tour isn't complete until you go all the way around, and then they hand out these pamphlets out there. I got a couple of them. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, birthplace in Akron, Ohio, and has photographs of the Mayflower Hotel, the lobby where Bill stood, and, the Gatehouse and St. Thomas Hospital. And my favorite is near the back is the picture, well, I don't know if I can find it that quickly, of the first AA coffee pot that Ann Smith, there it is, the AA coffee pot, this little teeny coffee pot down here, that was used to make the coffee at the first, and you know, everybody who's looked at this pan, let me see that coffee pot. I just want to, who the hell else would look at a coffee pot but a bunch of drunks? Yeah, well, that didn't hold very much, did it? No, it was a very small group, and so on down. But it really is, if you get a chance, it's really wonderful to see how this all, you know, and just experience it, because it is such a miracle. Now, next week, we'll pick up with how they started with just two people and grew into 2 million, 125 countries, how this incredible growth occurred, all the mistakes that were made in the beginning, and how this organization almost died about 15 times. I mean, it came right up to the cliff and could have fallen over, except for a very special event that would occur that kept it on track. And that's the best part of the story. So please come back next week. We're at the end of the time, and we have a great way to wrap it up with the Lord's Prayer.